Lounge is 12 o'clock. WBAI, New York. Time for Natural Living with Gary Noh.
Some may not survive. With allegations of malfeasance, a small but vocal group of dissidents was able to wrest control of the Pacifica board and implement its own political agenda. This seizure of control of the Pacifica board occurred during a 12-month period from January 2001 to December 2002. The average listener at the five Pacifica stations has only heard bits and pieces of information and is not fully aware of the facts that led to this confrontation and the subsequent events. This report is meant to provide an objective, fair-minded review and investigation of the issues to determine the facts concerning the dispute. I took no sides and I have no agenda to promote. I know no one in particular and have had no special friends on either side of this dispute. My social and professional associations have little to do with Pacifica, the dissenters, the progressives, or the individual station managers. I hope this report serves as a reflection on what went wrong at Pacifica during a four-year period from 1998 through 2002, and most importantly, what can be done either to rebuild or to surrender the legacy of our founder, Lou Hill. The roots of the Pacifica crisis can be traced in part to the 1999 conflict over who would control radio station KPFA in Berkeley. The removal of KPFA's general manager, Nicole Suella, by then Pacifica executive director Lynn Chadwick, started a chain of events that divided the network's managers, staff, volunteer producers, and listeners into two warring camps. Those camps, for purposes of this report, are designated as the progressives, meaning those who supported standards of behavior, practice, and accountability, and the dissidents, who saw Pacifica as a central organizing institution of the American political left wing and feared the standards of broadcasting promoted by the progressives or the commercialization of the airwaves. The growing financial crisis that began enveloping the Pacifica network in the 1990s alarmed many board members, many of whom came from traditional business backgrounds and were unfamiliar with the perpetual crisis in bookkeeping and fundraising that typified Pacifica affairs. The Pacifica National Board thus historically shied away from confrontation with many of its artistic but contentious staffers who were under pressure. Employees with grievances, anxious to stay on the air and retain the celebrity status and credibility broadcasting conferred on them as ipso facto spokespeople for their various political communities, had nowhere to turn for non-litigious support or guidance or reconciliation. Enter the accessible dissidents, whose well-oiled agenda would provide all but the third factor, true reconciliation, which could only have been attained through access to the closed Pacifica board. It's similar to a street gang being there for you when your well-meaning parents are absorbed at a concert. Pacifica has an unusual mission for a radio network. The Pacifica Foundation was founded to provide a voice for the voiceless, a forum for debating the world's great issues, and as an outlet for stimulating intellectual content not heard anywhere else on radio. Unlike most commercial stations, Pacifica was not meant to attract sponsors. intellectual pacifist Lewis Hill spearheaded the creation of Pacifica based on his idea that news and other programming should be derived from varied sources not commonly used by other radio stations. The goal, Hill felt, was to present a broad spectrum of differing opinions, views, and cultural offerings. Today, the five stations are part of the Pacifica legacy: KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, KPFT in Houston, and WPFW in Washington, D.C. Pacifica's first station was KPFA in Berkeley, where for many years the foundation was headquartered. The current national offices are in Washington, D.C., but shortly to go to Pacifica's outlet in Berkeley. Although each station has its own local advisory board, or lab, the original vision was that Pacifica should be run in a top-down fashion by its national board. The national board was at first, then for years, comprised of people who managed KPFA, which was their only station. Because absentee and separate board of directors historically have been a source of misunderstanding and obstruction, Lewis Hill designed that the formation of Pacifica and KPFA to be one. That is, those who owned the radio station were also the KPFA staff who actually broadcast and carried out its policies. Rather than a federation of collectives, founder Lou Hill saw the enterprise as a kind of a co-op as it worked toward the enlightenment of all the listeners. The purpose of a co-op is to work with others for mutual benefit. But when I started my program, Natural Living, in the late 1970s at New York's WBAI, I was surprised to find a cauldron of conflict in contrast to Lewis Hill's vision of cooperation. WBAI was a place where small interest groups always seemed to be generating big fights. Marxists, radicals, ghetto programming advocates, and others jockeyed for power in squabbles that were irrelevant to anyone outside of the particular cliques involved. Various factions gained programming ascendancy at various times in a station environment that can charitably be described as freewheeling. Throughout my more than two decades at Pacifica, there has never been a time without factions and individuals jockeying for power and control using on-air personal attacks. I just accepted this is a normal course of business at WBAI. So while liberty certainly prevailed, there was never the sense of peace that pacifist Lewis Hill sought. The station did, however, manage to air several good programs, no, actually outstanding programs, and this served as a lightning rod for the progressive social movement to address issues that the other media simply did not. It certainly has been an invaluable experience working here. So when asked by many of my listeners to investigate the current conflict, I did so without having an awareness of who was right. Since I had taken no sides in my entire tenure, I could, with some sense of objectivity, examine the various allegations to determine what's factual and what's not. It is with this background, then, that I discuss the last and most destructive of the Pacifica conflicts, the so-called coup and counter-coup, that have been recently roiled through the whole network. First, the allegations. In December of 2000, I was away from New York on tour when I was told that station manager WBAI Valerie Van Isler had been abruptly fired. I immediately called Valerie Van Isler, and she informed me that, yes, there had been a firing without notice, and I said, why? And she said she was not aware. I said, is there anything I can do to help? And she says, contact the board. I tried. I contacted every number I knew and or could get my hands on, but to no avail. I was simply shut out of any communication. I said I would do what I could as soon as I returned to see what was occurring. Also, there have been additional massive firings taking place. And this coup was the first step in a plan being carried out by a group that wanted to take over the Pacifica Foundation. My email was flooded with demands from my listeners that I must join the dissidents who claimed that they were trying to stop the coup, with warnings that if I did not join the dissidents, I'd be thrown off the air. I had many questions. First, I asked, who was behind the supposed coup? The allegations were that it was a group of multinational supporters, ultra-capitalists, and rabid right-wingers who had infiltrated Pacifica's national board and were trying to make the station sound like National Public Radio. Why? The answer was that these board members would then be in a position to sell the Pacifica stations. According to a radio marketing expert, WBAI and KPFA, both commercial licenses, could be worth between $80 and $150 million each. The dissident's story was that by changing the foundation bylaws, these so-called manipulative supporters of the business elite would be clear in their efforts to sell the stations, from which, according to the dissidents, they would make upwards of a 10% personal commission. During a series of investigative programs at the height of the conflict, I attempted to get to the root causes of this conflict and find a solution. I spoke with New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez, who was also co-host of Pacifica's Democracy Now. Gonzalez had resigned from the program, anchored by long-term Pacifica producer Amy Goodman, to become one of the leaders of the dissidents. To help explain the genesis of the conflict, Gonzalez elaborated on the problems that some people saw with the foundation's bylaws. Quote, "I think what's happening in the past few years, unbeknownst to many of us who were not paying close attention, is that the board at Pacifica had instituted a series of changes, many of which are suspect as to whether they're even legally able to do that," unquote. Gonzalez went on to put his finger on what he claimed was the critical issue. Quote, "The decision to take away the power of the labs, local advisory boards of the five stations, to have a say in who would sit on the board, and then the decision of the board increasingly to prevent anyone who opposed it, either in the labs, in the staff, or among the listeners, to voice their concern over this policy direction," unquote. According to Gonzalez, the Pacifica National Board had, quote, "set in motion a movement towards dictatorship, a dictatorship very similar to many of the other for-profit corporations that many of us here in capitalist America have grown accustomed to having to deal with. But we never expect we'd have to deal with it at Pacifica," unquote. Gonzalez announced that in reaction to the board, the dissenters had, quote, "launched a campaign to end what we've called the corporate takeover of Pacifica, an attempt to ape corporate models of decision-making and top-down orders and policies at Pacifica, aping that has occurred in the rest of America and, unfortunately, what has occurred in the rest of the mass media," unquote. Gonzalez explained why he was uneasy with members of the national board. Quote, "I realize that many of the current people do not come from the progressive movement that made Pacific what it is. They did not come out of mass struggles. They did not come out of major battles of the civil rights movement or the movement for Puerto Rican liberation or black liberation or environmental movement. They're basically like Clinton New Democrats, technocrats basically, who saw in Pacifica an underutilized resource that they could take in a direction that they envision as part of their agenda," unquote. In Gonzalez's view, those board members, now all gone, disdained the movement that had gave rise to Pacifica. Quote, "They have this attitude that the listeners of the Pacifica, many of them are stuck back in the 1960s. They're stuck in the radical era of the past," unquote, a point of view that Gonzalez openly disdained. Gonzalez further claimed that the Pacifica National Board, quote, "does not have a right to utilize the illegal, dictatorial means to impose their viewpoint on the rest of the staff, on the listeners, and on the communities that have long seen Pacifica as a beacon of dissent and progressive thought and culture in America," unquote. Juan Gonzalez played a key role as head of the dissidents' national organization called the Pacifica Campaign. Gonzalez is a founder of the 1960s radical group known as the Young Lords, which was based on the politics of the Black Panther Party. With the demise of the Young Lords in the 1970s, Gonzalez continued on to head a National Congress for Puerto Rican Rights, a more moderate group dedicated to voter registration. Born in New York and brought into New York City, Gonzalez graduated from Columbia University and has built a career in journalism, the winner of a 1998 George Polk Journalism Award and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Hispanic Academy of Media Arts and Sciences. He has been a daily columnist for the New York Daily News since 1988. But Gonzalez seems to have allowed his experience and credibility to evaporate in his treatment of the Pacifica crisis. Gonzalez gave the progressive movement to the dissident, but never interviewed the members that were being attacked from the progressive faction. Instead, Gonzalez participated in the vilification of the progressives. Many of his statements regarding the dissidents and the motives were not supported by facts. One of the most disturbing events was when a dissident activist and former Pacifica employee launched a homophobic attack on Pacifica's national program director, Steve Yatsko. Both Gonzalez and co-host Amy Goodman appeared to defend the attack on Yatsko. Steve Yatsko complained that he was a victim of a conspiracy meant to destroy him personally. He reported that a certain individual who was part of the Pacifica campaign directed this conspiracy. Yatsko explained that to teach himself computer skills, he set up a small personal web homepage under the name of Alter Ego, character name Mike Bilt, that was dedicated to travel for the gay community. Yatsko says part of an original version of his website was inadvertently left posted after he started a new version. Still posted on the old site was a page linked to a site called HillarysHair.com that was dedicated to, quote, critiquing Senator changes in Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's hairstyle. The Hillary Hair site had been reviewed in the news, and Yatsko said it was, quote, entertaining, cute, and not malicious. Long after Yatsko forgot about his original web page, which was still partly up on the web server run by his ISP, the domain name was trounced, a computer term for when an abandoned web page is surreptitiously taken over, usually by a pornography site. According to Yatsko, that's what happened to HillarysHair.com, and he adds that when this individual associated with the Pacifica campaign found out that HillarysHair.com had become a porn site, they, quote, pounced on it, unquote. Later, ABC radio talk show host Lynn Samuels, a former WBAI producer, broadcast the trumped-up sex charges mentioning Yasko's name on WABC. Yatsko responded that there was, quote, no tangible reason to destroy my life. The only thing Amy Goodman was asked to do was behave and report to her supervisor. There was never anything we asked her not to do, unquote. Yatsko claimed that the individual responsible for smearing him worked closely with Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. He added that they were actively looking to discredit him and that he discovered that, quote, Amy and Juan wanted my resume to try to show I wasn't qualified for the job as Pacifica's national program director, unquote. Yatsko learned the depth of the campaign against him after he got a phone message from his agent he'd worked with for years urging him to, quote, get your resume quick, there's a major market job opening, unquote. Yatsko was skeptical but provided his agent with the information and left for a business meeting in New York. That night, Yasko's cell phone started ringing. He said that the caller was impersonating a member of the board of directors of a major market station in California that was supposedly interested in him. The caller said, quote, why do you come to New York to fire Amy Goodman? Yatsko answered that the caller was wrong and that, quote, Amy is a treasured voice on Pacifica. There are no plans to fire Amy Goodman, unquote. Afterwards, his partner told him he had earlier fielded a call from the same person who had just called Yatsko, and he had given him Yasko's cell number. Why? Because he claimed he was the station manager of this station that was interested in hiring Yatsko. Yatsko said that his home phone number was on his resume. The following day, according to Yatsko, his resume and cell phone number were posted on the internet by the individual from the Pacifica campaign who harassed him for days with what he described as, quote, lies and impersonations. Amy Goodman is a longtime broadcaster who moved on to WBAI as a reporter and then news director before she began hosting Democracy Now! In 1995. Goodman's name became national news on November 12, 1991, when she was present in East Timor during a massacre of Timorese independence demonstrators by Indonesian troops. The presence of American citizens got the shootings mentioned in a news briefing by Bush press spokesman Richard Boucher. Goodman and her partner, reporter Alan Narum, later testified about the massacre before Congress, and both had become activists in the Timorese independence cause. Goodman's notoriety and reporting skills contributed to Pacifica's decision in 1995 to offer her the slot as a national program host. The program eventually became known as Democracy Now!, with its slogan, quote, the exception to the rulers, unquote. Goodman eventually gave up her position as WBAI news director, which she had held concurrently with her position as Democracy Now! Host, but she continued on as a co-host of the WBAI local morning show Wake Up Call, together with WBAI program director Bernard White. According to former Pacifica staffers, Goodman was paid a part-time salary by BAI to serve as Wake Up Call co-host, although she also received a full-time salary at the same time from Pacifica as host of Democracy Now!, a situation that caused consternation among some of Goodman's colleagues. WBAI was always in a red and, as always, short of cash, and some complained she was receiving resources that the WBAI news department sorely needed. Goodman and her allies went forward toward JASCO, and in doing so, exposed some of the roots of the events that occurred in the late summer and fall of 2000. JASCO had been hired in August as national program director, making him Goodman's immediate supervisor. Within 3 months, Goodman and JASCO were at loggerheads. The result would be the filing of a formal grievance by Goodman, which included a major complaint against JASCO for gender discrimination that was investigated by Pacifica and by AFTRA, which represented Goodman. JASCO gave a memo reprimand to Goodman with a list of work rules on October 16, 2000. Then Goodman responded with an email letter addressed to Pacific Executive Director Bessie Wash on October 18, 2000. Goodman stated in her letter, quote, "Several of the new rules target me and are outright attempts to curtail my constitutional rights of free speech. I have now filed grievances against Pacifica's management, charging harassment, gender harassment, and censorship, among other violations of my union contract," unquote. Copies of Goodman's letter went onto the Internet beginning on October 19th. Goodman denies she made the letter public. On October 22nd, Pacifica posted their response to Goodman on the Pacifica Foundation website, and on November 1st, New York attorney Michael Ratner, representing Goodman, wrote a letter suggesting, among other charges, that, quote, certain of her supervisors at the Pacifica Foundation that Goodman had been subjected to had created a campaign of harassment and abuse, unquote, by JASCO. Goodman reveals in her letter of October 18, 2000, in which she announces the filing of the formal grievances, quote, "In fact, union officials dissuaded me 2 weeks ago before the meeting," and she refers to the meeting of October 16th, at which time she says, quote, "JASCO handed me the memo," unquote, "in the law office of her union, AFTRA, from filing a formal grievance against JASCO and Pacifica for harassment because they had been led to believe Pacifica wanted to resolve these conflicts amicably," unquote. Thus, the issuance of JASCO's memo appears to have been the catalyst that finally enabled Amy to file her formal grievance. Had JASCO been provoked into writing a disciplinary memo as part of a setup to launch the grievance and ignite the Pacifica battle against a campaign that was about to ensue? It is possible, based upon how quickly copies of Goodman's letter on October 18th to Bessie Wash poured out onto the Internet, that Goodman and her supporters may have been looking for a fight. JASCO's the disciplinary memo to Goodman had, in contrast, been kept confidential. It is also possible that Goodman and her lawyer may have been disingenuous about the cause of the dispute between Goodman and Pacifica. One of the problems was Pacifica's outrage over Goodman's inappropriate reporting from the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia in late July and early August 2000. On August 2, 2000, as Republican vice presidential nominee Dick Cheney was accepting the nomination, Green Party candidate Ralph Nader, accompanied by Amy Goodman, entered the convention floor and gave an impromptu news conference. Former Pacifica staffers say that Goodman provided Pacifica press credentials to Nader, which they maintain caused the Republicans to pull all Pacifica press passes for the remainder of the convention. Goodman's attorney, Michael Ratner, speaking on behalf of Amy Goodman, denies in a letter of November 1, 2000, to Pacifica that Goodman gave the pass to Nader. Quote, "Ralph Nader did go to the convention floor at the Republican convention, but this was not facilitated by the use of press credentials by either Amy Goodman or Democracy Now! Employees. Ralph Nader entered the convention at the invitation of MSNBC. Democracy Now! Arranged an interview with him in the hallways of the convention. He was soon surrounded by numerous journalists, and he walked onto the floor without the necessary floor pass and without being stopped by security," unquote. The Pacifica Foundation stand on this matter in their press release of October 22, 2000, quote, "A statement from the Pacifica Foundation on its award-winning Democracy Now! Is as follows in the section entitled Democracy Now! Created in its own problems with respect to receiving press credentials for the Democratic National Convention," unquote. As has been widely reported, Democracy Now! Provided Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader a floor pass to the Republican National Convention, which occurred a few weeks prior to the Democratic National Convention. The Democracy Now! Website, without Pacifica's knowledge, said the candidate had been, quote, smuggled onto the floor using a journalist pass, unquote. As a result, the Congressional Press Gallery, who issues convention credentials, became concerned that members of the Pacifica National Programming Unit covering the Democratic Convention would engage in similar events. The Nader incident at the Republican Convention put all of Pacifica in danger of not receiving credentials for the Democratic Convention and could even have jeopardized our congressional press credentials for use on Capitol Hill in the White House. A management decision was made in light of the Nader incident at the Republican National Convention to protect the Foundation's access to official press credentials by not providing credentials to the staff of Democracy Now! For the Democratic National Convention. According to Bessie Walsh, quote, Steve Yasko and Garland Gander had to talk up a blue streak, unquote, in order to stop the Democratic National Committee from banning all of Pacifica's reporters, including reporters from each of the five stations, from covering the convention that was held in Los Angeles later in August 2000. Currently, the Democracy Now! Website archives the broadcast of a tape of Nader's comments on the convention floor, including Amy Goodman's introductory remarks, delivered live prior to her playing the tape with some grandstanding as follows, quote, well, folks, history was made last night at the Republican convention, and we're not talking about Dick Cheney's speech. It was what happened on the convention floor while he spoke. In what is believed to be the first time in U.S. history, a candidate for president held an impromptu but well-attended press briefing on the convention floor of an opposing party. We're talking about Ralph Nader. In fact, we had asked him to come to the convention. We wanted him to provide commentary and analysis. The networks think nothing of bringing in opposition Democrats, but these political figures still invariably reinforce the official line. We brought in Ralph Nader as the voice of an outsider who's been excluded from the political process in many ways. From the moment we arrived, scores of board reporters desperate for a story, as well as delegates and politicians, swarmed around Ralph Nader as we began our journey to the convention floor, unquote. It's clear from the Democracy Now! Archives, in Amy Goodman's own words, that she was a strong supporter of Nader, and many believe have sacrificed her journalistic objectivity to become an advocate of the Green Party candidate. According to Walsh, Goodman's actions, quote, put Pacifica's broadcast licenses in jeopardy, unquote. Interestingly enough, Green Party members were among the strongest supporters of Goodman in her 2001 battle with Pacifica. As Walsh points out, Goodman's behavior threatened Pacifica's license with the Federal Communications Commission and also threatened the access of the other 500-plus producers at the five Pacifica radio stations. If Garland Gander, Steve Yasko, had not been able to convince Democratic conventions officials to grant press credentials, none of the Pacifica producers would have been allowed into the convention hall. Goodman's ambush style of journalism endangered Pacifica and another important confrontation. A telephone interview with President Bill Clinton at WBAI on Election Day, 2007, November 7th. On that afternoon, Clinton had been calling radio stations across the country urging listeners to vote. But when he called WBAI program Alternativa Latina, Goodman jumped in on the call and began attacking the surprised Clinton with a barrage of questions. Among the questions Goodman asked was one about whether Clinton would pardon American Indian leader Leonard Pelletier, who was serving 25 years to life sentence in the shooting deaths of two FBI agents in 1975. Goodman's interview with Clinton was an embarrassing form of showboating that placed Pacifica producers' access to interviews with the United States president in jeopardy. In the end, Goodman's much-publicized confrontational manner with Clinton might have helped convince him not to pardon Pelletier under harassment. Goodman's badgering of Clinton may have given him the excuse he needed to heed the protest of anti-Pelletier FBI agents who had been picketing the White House. Goodman certainly would have known about that since she had had several of the FBI agents on Democracy Now! To discuss their opposition to a pardon. A calm appeal to Clinton's compassionate side might have helped to forward Pelletier's cause. The effect of Goodman's actions to slam another door on other Pacifica producers and the cumulative effect of her irresponsible reporting style was to further alienate decision makers from expressing themselves on Pacific radio stations. Goodman's supporters consider her efforts to be remarkable, heroic, and support her confrontational style. Not everyone does. Yasko claimed that Goodman was, quote, relentless, demanding, and accusatory, unquote, on two particular occasions, quote, once at a board meeting and a second time at a meeting of general managers, unquote. According to Yasko, quote, discussions of Goodman has always been a struggle, unquote. And on at least one occasion, she was reduced, quote, to shaking and crying, unquote, during a phone conversation in which Goodman claimed Yasko screamed at her as she told Yasko repeatedly, you're breaking me, unquote. Following this interchange, Yasko sent Goodman a memo inquiring about her health in light of the hours that she had been claiming to work. According to one of Goodman's co-workers, Gonzalez, once told Goodman that there was no reason to work 36 straight hours. Now, I will, in addition, in later on in this discussion, I will go into some of these details and a little more specifically. There was another part of the challenge that was being brought forward. And that was that there was a challenge in the way that the local labs, the local advisory boards, and the national board were interfacing. Bernard White, the current program director of WBAI, was one of the people who felt that there was a lack of communication. Speaking on my WBAI radio program after the conflict broke out, Bernard White said he felt that the problem was caused by alienation of the labs by the National Board as a result of his decision to, quote, sever the relationship, unquote, with the local advisory boards. According to Bernard White, the National Board had decided that, quote, anyone who was a member of the local advisory board could not be on the National Board, unquote. At the same time, according to White, quote, there were discussions taking place to sell two of the radio stations, KPFA in Berkeley and as well as WBI in New York. This seemed to be an act that was a precursor to moving forward to sell these radio stations, unquote. Contrary to many of the dissidents' beliefs or assertions, well-intentioned may have been, there was never an attempt by anyone to sell any Pacifica station, nor could anyone provide me with evidence of such an effort. And the basic changes that they were seeking was a change of governance, according to Bernard White, in terms of how board members were selected. And there was an increasing attempt by the board to silence any opposition to what many believe were unjust, illegal methods that they employed to change their own bylaws to basically shut out listeners and the community from any direct participation in the governance of Pacifica, unquote. Bernard White charged that Pacifica was becoming increasingly undemocratic. He claimed that, quote, the information flowing from the bottom, which would be the lab, to the National Board impacting on decision-making that was taken out. The only decision-making taking place was happening at the top without any real input from the bottom, unquote. Echoing charges by Gonzalez that the Pacifica board members were disconnected from the listener community at WBAI, White asserted, quote, you had people on the National Board who are not familiar with community radio. Most of them didn't have that as part of their legacy of work. They have more in mind in a corporate model, which is a top-down model. That's how they've been behaving, unquote. Bernard White was correct. The Pacifica National Board did fail miserably to embrace the democratic process by resisting open, generous communication with lab members, an outreach which I believe might have restored balance to heal rifts between factions. Board members weren't even speaking with other board members. There was an enormous amount of conflict. There was no substantial exchange between the board and the labs, and the board's failure to communicate with the labs reflected poorly on the board as a governing body chartered to foster communication in the world. White also offered an interesting analysis of the hiring and firing procedures of Pacifica stations. Quote, it would stand to reason that they would see nothing wrong with reaching into a WBAI, snatching a station manager in violation of the bylaws, the rules that clearly state that in order to remove a station manager, it must be done in consultation with the lab as well as with the staff. This did not happen. This is the kind of heavy-handedness that we've been seeing since these folks came onto the National Board, unquote. All of the dissidents, however, were wrong about the bylaws. The Pacifica bylaws do not require that the executive director get permission from the lab or anyone else to replace the station manager. And yet many individuals felt that was actually what should have been done. Now, here's what my investigation has determined. And by the way, the pressure on me to join the Pacifica dissidents continued to mount, and indeed, I often sided with members of the dissidents as far as having the most dissidents on my program to discuss their particular point of view and some of their common causes, even from AIDS to globalization. On the other hand, I'm not one to accept any story, let alone join any group, with an agenda before looking into the issues carefully and in depth. Were the allegations here true? Were their facts either substantiated or refuted? Those questions led me and many other individuals to conduct over 800 hours of research and interviews. My results? First, the mass firings. At the beginning, there were no employee purges. Only one person was fired, WBAI station manager Valerie Venisler. And she was not summarily fired without notice, as had been widely publicized. My investigation reveals that Valerie Venisler had been having problems at WBAI. Disliked by some, highly respected and loved by others. She was reported to have been obstreperous in dealing with the United Electrical Workers Unit Local 404, which at the time represented WBAI paid and unpaid staff. Someone even described her as a union buster. Other individuals stated that Valerie Venisler was not the best organizer and challenged her managerial skills, though many individuals stated that she was an extraordinarily dedicated human being and had been an asset to BAI over the years. There had been talk of people wanting to replace her for some time. Bessie Walsh told me during a live interview on WBI that Venisler's firing was, quote, part of a progressive disciplinary action. I assess each manager differently based upon a set of goals that were both set down and put together for the station and managers themselves. The decision was based on whether or not these were going to be met, unquote. One of the changes demanded by Bessie Walsh was the relationship between Venisler and Amy Goodman. And according to Walsh, there was a leadership vacuum at WBAI and that she wanted a different type of management. Quote, in my tenure, I was responsible for making sure that this occurred. Even when Valerie Venisler did not, according to Walsh, make the changes she had asked for, Venisler was invited to take a better job within the foundation at higher pay. According to witnesses who were in the conversations that I interviewed, Venisler was offered a position as executive producer in Washington, D.C. with a $7,000 a year raise and added benefits. Pacific would also have paid her expenses for commuting and living in Washington and New York several days a week, or between the two. Walsh says that she bent over backwards for Venisler in recognition of her long and dedicated years of service to Pacifica, and that she had been offered a golden parachute to step up, not out of Pacifica. All of this occurred during a six-month period prior to the alleged coup. It was only after Venisler repeatedly declined that offer that Bessie Walsh dismissed her, an action Walsh found difficult because the two had worked together as colleagues for many years. At that point, Venisler was given a month to leave, the month of December, because a new station manager was going to be brought in. So that was the actual story behind the Pacifica so-called purges. I contend that if Valerie Venisler had come forward after her dismissal to confirm that no coup had occurred and there was no takeover of the stations, that she had simply declined the offer in Washington of Bessie Walsh, and that she and Bessie Walsh had different opinions of how WBI should be run. Venisler had her own opinion and right to it of how she believed, as a longtime manager, the station should be run, and many people agreed with her. But Bessie Walsh had her opinion. In the end, it was Bessie Walsh who was the boss, and she was the one who could make the final decision. Venisler had supporters, still does have supporters, who appreciated the project she had done well, at a very high level, exemplary. And they would have been mollified by her reassurances. But Venisler allowed that opportunity to pass. She was not part of a purge, yet she didn't say she wasn't. In fact, she may possibly even have allowed people around her to believe that there was a purge. And if that is the case, then Bernard White and others were misled. And because many people then spoke out vigorously and with great passion about Van Esser's firing. And Van Esser became the player around whom the dissidents rallied to forward their cause. This could have been avoided had she been forthright with her followers for the circumstances of her departure and refusal to accept the transfer and promotion to the national office. Two other facts must be noted in relation to this topic. One is that Van Esser was to be replaced not by an outsider, as many contended, but by the very respected news director of BAI, Jose Santiago. Another fact which surfaced in a memo, a series of memos that I came across from some computers, was that at least several of the very people who would rally around Van Esser and use her as the dissident's champion had in recent past condemned her and asked the executive director at the same time to get rid of her. I have those memos. After Van Esser's departure, news director Jose Santiago, the person who was slated to be WBI's interim station manager, was someone who had already been working within the station and proven himself capable and trustworthy. So it wasn't as if some unknown newcomer was being imposed upon the staff. Unfortunately, after Santiago initially accepted the new position, staffers sympathetic to Van Esser were menacing to Santiago and made allegations that went over the line of simple disagreement. These challenges came at a time when a member of Santiago's family was undergoing a major health crisis and led Santiago to step down. At least part of the reason the WBI staff was hostile to Santiago taking the helm was that it had been Bessie Walsh at the national board level who had appointed him, and this was seen as undemocratic. The reality is, though, that the foundation bylaws mandated this chain of command, i.e., it is the executive director at the national level who has the exclusive authority to hire and fire the general managers of the stations. For 50 years, this has been the required procedure that has been followed. When Santiago turned down the interim station manager position, Bessie Walsh asked others. None wanted it. One, however, was convinced, and that was Utrice Lead. She had been a long-term program host on WBAI. Lead stepped up to the plate, saying she'd accept the job if certain conditions were agreed to at the national level. Namely, there would be no firings, no bannings, and no interference by anyone at the board in how the station should be run. These terms were accepted, and so on December 23, 2000, Lead became the interim station manager at BAI. Her goal, as she saw it, was to set up and maintain professional standards at the station and to help the staff upgrade its skills and better craft of the radio station. But she only wanted to be in charge until a permanent station manager was hired. It was not Lead's ambition to become the permanent station manager herself. Indeed, she had been one of the few people who had encouraged Santiago to take the job. In fact, went to Santiago and pleaded with him, "Do keep this job. Don't step aside." Numerous individuals interviewed for this report stated that at BAI, there was a small clique that was afraid of losing Van Esser. The contention was that Van Esser, when there, allowed standards that they could do pretty much what they wanted. Some quoted, quote, "it was a free-for-all." Pacifica's former managers say that, quote, "professionalism was all anybody wanted, but people at BAI didn't want to be judged or held accountable to some manager's standards." Hence, a lot of people felt that if someone new was brought in that they didn't know, might be judging them by a different standard. To be totally fair, there needs to be some discussion of what I believe were errors made by Utrice Lead during her stint as WBI interim general manager. This critique must be taken into the context of a tense situation exacerbated by the uncompromising positions asserted by all participants, limiting possible solutions to a narrow and increasingly confrontational range. If either side had been willing to sit down civilly and compassionately and negotiate early in the conflict, most of the expenses and traumas of the past 18 months could have been avoided. The roots of the internal conflict at BAI are deep, but for purposes of this report, I will only begin with the unexpected and tragic death of Samori Marksman, who had almost single-handedly kept a dysfunctional organization functioning over the past decade. With the passing of this highly respected marksman on March 23, 1999, a committee of WBAI staffers and volunteers was formed to recommend a new program director to Van Isler, who under Pacifica's bylaws had final say of any candidate. The committee met for months in interviewing numerous applicants and eventually narrowed the field to a few, with Utrecht Lead at the top of the list. Now, Van Isler rejected the committee recommendations and chose Bernard Voigt for the job, claiming cryptically that the committee process, quote, had been tainted, unquote. Shortly after Van Isler was removed, Bernard Voigt was fired by Bessie Walsh on December 23, 2000, without cause. It was the opinion of Bessie Walsh that Voigt had been using his form to criticize the board unfairly. Others felt that there should never have been a gag rule. On the same day that Voigt was fired, Utrecht Lead was appointed interim general manager. It's the conclusion of this report that Utrecht Lead would have made a fine station host, which she was, but I do not know what her qualifications would have been as a general manager. Possibly a good program director, but she did not show the skills that I believe were necessary to be an effective station manager. In my opinion, Utrecht Lead made several very important mistakes in her tenure as general manager. These mistakes, in my personal opinion, were as follows. One, Utrecht Lead never should have taken people off the air summarily. If they were doing something wrong, Lead should have allowed established procedure to work on behalf of the people being challenged and the station. For example, she should not have supported the firing of Bernard Voigt. That was wrong, especially not as her first action as general manager, but could instead have allowed the process to go through the normal union channels for grievance through arbitration. This is especially true in Bernard White's case because he held the title of program director, a role that Utrecht had been in line for. The miasma of competition gone awry may always surround her cooperation in the firing of Bernard White for that reason, whether or not the competition actually played a part. Had she given White the benefit of a doubt, which he deserved, or recused herself from the case, the damaging fallout of anger that resulted from this poor management decision would have been minimal or would not have occurred. Number two, Lead should never have gone into the radio station and removed Ken Nash from the air because he was saying things about her. Boundaries must be respected. Free speech is what it is. We may like it, not like it, may be right, may be wrong, may be intelligent, honest, dishonest. No matter what, it must remain free. Number three, Lead should not have allowed her supporters to broadcast their attacks on the air against those who have been banned and fired. The gag rule should have been applied equally to everyone. The banned and fired, disenfranchised as they were, experienced high frustration as they were attacked by those who still had a microphone to use as an inappropriate weapon. The banning and fired had no recourse, and their fury escalated. A raging us versus them atmosphere was fostered in the absence of the balance that was needed for healing. Four, Lee did not go out into the community to explain what had happened. Instead, she hunkered down, looking to make changes too fast. Five, Lee should not have replaced fired and banned producers, even temporarily, with anyone that she was a friend or a crony with or had worked with in the past. This created the appearance of nepotism. Six, Lead was too sensitive to the criticisms made by the dissidents, and she allowed them to push her into a bunker siege mentality. Now, I must also note that Lead rose to the occasion after the September 11th attacks, keeping WBA on the air, and met programming challenges while conducting successful fund drives, and also while being personally attacked, slandered, and libeled non-stop. Next, were the stations actually for sale? My investigation has found no evidence existing to substantiate the story that there was a corporate effort to sell Pacifica stations. Frank Millspaugh, Pacifica board member who managed WBAI in the late 1960s, elaborates, quote, "The business about selling the stations and the proceeds going to the board of directors is ridiculous. You can't do that. It's against the law. We all would have gone to jail," unquote. Ex-board member Ken Ford says, quote, "There was no attempt to sell any station. We discussed trying to raise funds to buy other stations, but there was no attempt. That was a blatant lie, and there's no evidence to substantiate it. If we were going to sell the stations and receive a 10% commission, first of all, that would be illegal. Secondly, no such financial arrangements were ever discussed, agreed to, or even contemplated," unquote. The whole brouhaha about station sales may be the result of misunderstanding or a distortion intentionally of facts. First, it's important to understand that Pacifica owns 5 radio broadcast licenses issued to it by the Federal Communication Commission. The foundation also owns the equipment, leases the property used to broadcast, but it's the licenses that are the real valuable assets. 2 of those licenses, KPFA and WBAI, are commercial licenses in that an owner of such a license could legally sell commercial time, unlike the other 3 Pacifica licenses, which are non-commercial, can only be used for non-profit purposes. Obviously, the 2 commercial licenses are worth far more than the 3 non-commercial licenses. Millspaugh explains, then, when he first became manager of WBAI, a former manager came to him and proposed that he support the concept of selling WBAI and replacing its signal locally with a non-commercial FM signal that might be available. The New York City Board of Education's non-commercial radio station, WNYE, was considered at one time a likely candidate for a Pacifica license swap. Millspaugh adds that over the years, the issue regularly was considered and rejected by the board. According to Millspaugh, quote, "Traditionally, there'd be one board member, not the same board member, but in each generation of board member, there'd be one, usually by from Houston, who would take the position that the 2 commercial licenses should be sold." He adds, quote, "I was opposed to that for a number of reasons. First, there was no equivalent signals in New York, and second, I thought it was politically undoable," unquote. Millspaugh explains the logic that originally drove the idea of selling the commercial licenses. Quote, "There were California board members who liked the idea because their original project had been to coat California with Pacifica stations. They saw themselves as primarily a California system that only took WBAI because it had been given to them. Some of them wanted to just sell it, take the proceeds and use it to develop a whole California-wide system of stations. It was partially to combat that I played a very active role in applying for the stations in Houston and Washington, D.C. I figured then, if 3 of the 5 stations are outside of California, California won't be trying to sell us off to build up California," unquote. The myth of a serious attempt by the Pacifica board to go beyond occasional discussions and rejection of the idea of swapping or selling a commercial license has been a central theme in the ideological arsenal of the dissident faction. In an ad paid for by the dissidents and run in the newspaper of media watchdog Fairness and Accuracy Media, Michael Palmer is described as having, quote, "authored a misdirected email in 1999 which strongly advocated the sale of either WBAI or Berkeley Station KPFA. In fact, on air it was stated, it was an ongoing discussion that was being held about the sale of KPFA and BAI. Michael Palmer stated that BAI would be the most likely one to be sold because there were advantages to selling it," unquote. However, an in-depth investigation of the allegation shows the truth is a lot more complicated. Board member Andreas Sisko says, quote, "There was a memo that Michael Palmer sent out in 1966 where he had investigated selling the stations, and that was not from the board. There is nowhere in the board meeting that we asked for that. Michael Palmer did that, and it got out to the public and it started this whole thing," unquote. Palmer, who I interviewed, agrees that he looked into a possible station swap of licenses, but he gives a more complete explanation and some supporting documentation. Quote, "In 1995, WBAI needed money. Only Berkeley was meeting its expenses. All the other stations were operating in a deficit. Pacifica was in a tight financial condition. Therefore, there was a retreat held in Oakland in 1996 to look at the big picture, a 5-year plan with Pacifica managers, staffers, lab members, and others to discuss the network's then current needs as well as to its future. The board asked attendees to come up with a wish list of resources, which they did. Palmer says that even Amy Goodman was an active participant making a proposal for Democracy Now. The quote, the wish list included better pay, more technical gear, better facilities, more staff, more technicians, more producers. They even wanted more programming And from this meeting, the first ever attended by Palmer, came a strategic plan to commemorate Pacifica's 50th anniversary by raising, through the network, $50 million. Palmer looked at the financial statements provided to the board members for the first time at the Oakland meeting and saw no money to finance these producers' wish lists. Palmer says, quote, "You didn't have to work for Arthur Andersen to see that there was no money," unquote. According to Palmer, Pacifica was, quote, "using subcarrier agreement money to cover the budget deficit at all the other stations. Subcarrier agreement money is raised by leasing unused parts of the radio spectrum belonging to Pacifica to private businesses."
It is 12:55, and you are listening to WBAI in New York, and you're hearing a white paper, I think is what it's called, being submitted by Gary Null. I'm just taking this moment out to give you a precursor of what will take place here in the near future, when we will have to have some people who come on who will provide some balance to what Gary Null has been saying. Gary Null has been speaking for just about an hour now, about some issues that he has come up with this white paper on, but concerning these issues. He's not spoken to many of the people that he's talking about. He hasn't spoken to Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez, Dan Coughlin, Valerie Van Isla, Sharan Louise Harper, Robert Knight. He has not spoken to me about this. However, he has come to conclusions that he feels comfortable with in delivering to our listenership. He quotes people like Bessie Wash. He talks about his conversations with Garland Ganter, as well as Stephen Yasko. Stephen Yasko, who was the former national program director, someone who throughout the industry is known as a person who's just not too swift, as well as a very nasty individual. He made certain assertions that were not true. There'll be further discussion about that later. I don't think that anyone takes to claim seriously that Amy Goodman endangered Pacifica. I think that that was something fabricated by both Bessie Wash and Steve Yasko regarding the conventions, both the Republican as well as the Democratic convention. There was an attempt to set the stage to sell stations and set up the framework for even to go as far as individual board members benefiting from the sale of a radio station, as well as their families could benefit from the sale. This was put forward by one of the board members as a possible amendment to the bylaws. In order to justify or to make all of this sound more rational, the scenario had to be developed around Valerie Van Isla. Valerie Van Isla was not fired according to proper protocol. It says very clearly in the bylaws that the station manager can only be fired after consultation with the local advisory board as well as the staff. That did not take place. It was not part of a progressive move to extract the station manager from the station. This was something that was done with Bessie Wash in consultation with Utrice Lead as well as some others here at the station. As terms of a leadership vacuum at WBAI, well, I don't know if there was a leadership vacuum. If you remember during that time, every fundraiser that was held was a record-making fundraiser. Our listenership was on the increase at that time, rivaling the kind of increase we had during the Vietnam War. There was a takeover. There was a coup. A coup did occur, and a downward spiral did ensue. And I think that took place because our listeners are not stupid. They realized the difference between the kinds of programming that was had during that coup period, and I think they can tell the difference between the kind of programming that we have now as a result of vanquishing those people who had held those positions. Did Lead maintain professional standards? No, I don't think that can be said, but then you be the judge. I think BAI is better now than it was during that period. Under Pacifica's bylaws, closing, under Pacifica's bylaws, the station manager has the right to appoint someone to any of the jobs here at